Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, December 21st. Excited to enter our second century. Midland Chamber commences 100th anniversary celebrations. Business and community members gathered Monday evening at the Midland Chamber of Commerce's centennial kickoff soiree to celebrate its upcoming 100th anniversary and begin a year-long commemoration of its accomplishments. Quote, "We wanted to launch into our 100th year looking back at highlights of the Chamber's many accomplishments over the last century," said Bobby Burns, who will retire as president and CEO on December 31st. Quote, "This chamber, your chamber, has left its mark on nearly every aspect of Midland life," end quote. The Midland Chamber was founded in January of 1924. Examples of initiatives created by or with the assistance of the Chamber, according to a news release from the Midland Chamber of Commerce, include the expansion of transportation infrastructure and the founding of MOTRAN, the recruitment of commercial air service to the Permian Basin, the passage of the Economic Development Tax leading to the creation of the Midland Development Corporation, and the forming of organizations such as Permian Basin Petroleum Association, United Way of Midland, Keep Midland Beautiful, Midland Memorial Hospital and Foundation, and Midland College. Quote, "The Midland Chamber has always been there to address the needs of our community," remarked Evan Thomas, current COO and incoming president and CEO. Quote, "We are excited to enter our second century and train our focus and energy on tackling the challenges to come," end quote. The evening was also a time to honor Burns for his many years of service to the Chamber, his three terms as mayor, and decades of community service. Quote, "It's been the privilege of a lifetime to lead this chamber for the past 12 years and work on behalf of Midland," Burns said. "It's seen much change and growth, and I am proud to leave it in Evan's capable hands," end quote. Congressman August Pfluger, State Senator Kevin Sparks, Speaker Tom Craddock, and Midland Mayor Lori Blong each presented proclamations dedicated to Burns, noting his passion for mentoring emerging leaders, persistence, and love for Midland. The evening ended with a toast to the Chamber's next 100 years and a successful future for Burns in his retirement. The next celebration will be the annual State of Oil and Gas Luncheon to be held at the Bush Convention Center on January 23rd, the 100th birthday of the Chamber. Tickets and sponsorship can be purchased at midland.biz. Energy industry enters holding pattern. Survey finds limited business activity growth from third to fourth quarter. The story was written by Mella McEwen, oil editor. Texas's energy industry entered a holding pattern in the fourth quarter, according to the quarterly Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas Energy Survey released Wednesday. Kunal Patel, senior business economist with the bank, said during a video call with media that the key takeaway from responses received from 144 energy firms was that there was limited business activity growth from the third quarter to the fourth quarter. Responses also indicated a sharp drop in the company outlook index, which sank over 40 points to a negative 12.4 from a positive 36 in the third quarter. At the same time, uncertainty jumped to 46.1 from 6.8 in the previous quarter. Patel attributed those results in large part to commodity price, when oil prices fell from an average over $80 in the third quarter to around $70 in the third. He noted the weakness in natural gas prices, which he said is unusual in winter when demand is usually highest. Quote, one comment said the key question is OPEC's ability to keep prices up. If they can keep their resolve in keeping prices up, he said. The record run of Permian Basin mergers and acquisitions, dominated by ExxonMobil's $64 billion acquisition of Pioneer Natural Resources and Occidental Petroleum's $12 billion purchase of Crown Rock, also added to participants' concerns. An overwhelming majority, 77%, expect additional very large acquisitions over the next 2 years. Respondents from the oil field service sector commented that the consolidation will impede growth and sustainability in the services sector and has already had a direct impact on the rig count and need for services. Quote, as exploration and production companies consolidate, they have more supplier power, so they can negotiate lower rates that could hurt service companies. Larger companies have increased negotiating power and economies of scale, explained Patel. The survey also found employment was little changed from the third quarter amid a sharp decline in the rig count and a slight decline in the number of fracturing crews. Quote, the industry has been incredibly lean and employment is nowhere near where it was in 2019, he said. He attributed that in part to steep gains in efficiencies that have yielded record oil and natural gas production with fewer rigs, as well as commodity cycles that have affected employment. There's also the perception among potential oil and gas professionals that the energy transition could mean limited opportunities. Looking to 2024, respondents largely do not expect capital spending to increase significantly from 2023 levels, with 33% predicting a slight increase and 26% expecting spending to remain close to 2023 levels. A majority of companies are predicting their budgets on oil prices between $70 and $80 a barrel. Oil production continued in the fourth quarter, though the pace slowed sharply from the third quarter. Patel said he expects that trend to continue, continued production growth, but at significantly lower levels. Responses revealed a divergence between small E&P companies, those producing less than 10,000 barrels a day, and large E&P companies that produce more than 10,000 barrels a day. A majority of respondents from smaller companies say their primary goal in 2024 is to grow production, while respondents from larger companies say their primary goal is to acquire assets or reduce debt levels. Shale bosses brace for more oil megadeals. The story was written by David Waith from Bloomberg. Shale bosses are bracing for more megadeals in the U.S. oil industry, and some fear the consequences of consolidation. Executives predict more monster acquisitions after Chevron Corporation's $53 billion takeover of Hess Corporation and ExxonMobil Corporation's purchase of Pioneer Natural Resources Company for $59.5 billion in October, according to a quarterly survey by the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas. For the companies that provide crews and equipment to oil producers, that's not good news. Quote, the consolidation of operators will impede the growth and sustainability of the oil field service sector, an unidentified respondent said in the report. This will lead to the demise of small independent oil and gas operators, as they will be unable to obtain reasonable pricing from the few remaining service providers, end quote. Oil prices will probably close 2024 at $78 a barrel, survey respondent said. That's $10 less than the prediction for year-end 2023 in last quarter's report. The market has been plagued by skepticism that OPEC Plus will adhere to production cuts and concerns that supplies from the U.S. are rising, though escalating geopolitical risks have recently introduced a premium. The Dallas Fed survey is widely read for its anonymous comments that offer an unfiltered view on a range of industry topics, from the White House to the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Executives were divided on strategy for next year. Many respondents from larger exploration companies said they plan to acquire assets, while those from smaller firms said they want to grow or maintain production. Quote, the policies of the administration continue to present significant headwinds, especially for smaller independents, one respondent said. Access to capital is constrained for small projects less than $50 million in size, end quote.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Thursday, December 21st, 2023. Happenings. Three things to do Christmas weekend, December 22nd and 23rd, by Morgan Taylor Thomas. Enjoy a holiday extravaganza at TCBC. Head over to Tall City Brewing Company to hang out with fellow locals in town for the holidays. Participate in an ugly sweater contest. Enjoy live music courtesy of Zach Webb. And get the first sip of the tap room's newest seasonal creation, Chai Milk Stout and Reindeer the 12th Ale. No entry fee required. Friday, doors open at noon. Events begin at 5 p.m. at 3303 West Golf Course. Munch on Cookies with Santa. The annual Cookies with Santa event held at Opal's Table downtown is back again. Cookies, cocoa, and milk make up the menu for littles, while festive drinks can be purchased for adults. Santa, of course, will be on site, having delicious sweet treats and posing for photos. Tickets should be purchased ahead of time at opalstable.com. Saturday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 223 West Wall. Check out the farmers market. Before the holidays come and go, make sure to stock up on all the ingredients you need for delicious puddings, desserts, roasts, soups, and other family food traditions you have. The downtown farmers market showcases all sorts of locally grown and handmade produce, products, salsa, seasoning, ingredients, and more. There are even options for last-minute gift buying. Saturday, 9 a.m. to noon at 404 North Colorado. What's Up with Midland, by Morgan Taylor Thomas. At the Big Spring State Park, Discovery Table, Skins and Skulls, December 30th. First Day Hike, Scenic Loop, January 1st. First Day Hike, Historic Carvings Walk, January 1st. at Centennial Park. Food Truck Takeover, December 27th. On Colorado Street, Downtown Farmers Market, new location every Saturday. At Cream Lab N7, Ice Cream Workshop with Santa and the Grinch, Friday. Downtown Odessa, first Friday, January 5th. Kendra Scott, Shine Bright and Do Good with Fix West Texas, Friday. At La Hacienda, Los Ilgueros del Arroyo y Conjunto Relincho, December 31st. At Opal's Table, Cookies with Santa, Saturday. Silver Oak Wine Dinner on New Year's Eve, December 31st. At Tall City Brewing Company, Geeks Who Drink Trivia every Tuesday. At Tall City Beer Run every Thursday. Ugly Sweater Party Friday. Live Music with Zach Webb Friday. Seasonal Beer Release Friday, all at Tall City Brewing Company. At Texas Sun Winery, Live Music with Craig Elliott, Friday. Paint with Me, January 16th. At the Wagner Knoll Performing Arts Center, The Nutcracker, Magical Christmas Ballet, December 27th. Ron White, January 11th. The Panhandlers, January 14th. West Texas Winds Spring Recital, January 18th. Breaking Benjamin Unplugged, January 23rd. Brian Reagan, January 25th. Jason Fabus Trio, January 27th. The Board Teachers Comedy Tour, January 28th. Pretty Woman the Musical, January 30th. All at the Wagner Knoll. At the Waystone, Fire Pit and S'mores Night, Thursday. Dice Miner Tournament and Blue Geo Pop-Up, December 28th.
Here are some obituaries that appeared in the Midland Reporter-Telegram on Thursday, December 21st. Narnie Reinhardt Buchanan was born April 15, 1932, in Garden Valley, Texas. She had been a resident of Midland for 11 years, formerly living in Mount Sylvan. She graduated from Van High School and attended Tyler Junior College. She was a member of Lindale Garden Club. Mrs. Buchanan enjoyed both growing and arranging flowers. She owned and worked at the Lindale Floral Shop for many years. Narnie married James F. Sonny Buchanan in 1956 in Van, Texas. They made their home in East Texas until Sonny's death in 2011. Shortly after, Narnie moved to Midland, where she enjoyed her life at the village at Manor Park, but her heart always belonged in East Texas. Narnie passed away at the age of 91 on December 18th in Midland. She was preceded in death by her husband, James F. Sonny Buchanan, her parents, Zeb and Bessie Reinhardt, siblings, Joyce Bax, Z.V. Reinhardt, Eugene Reinhardt, Keith Reinhardt, and Mary Frances Ellison DuBose, two nephews and two nieces. Survivors include her two daughters and sons-in-law, Kay and Tom Zeltman of Midland, and Kathy and Mark Benny of College Station, and a grandson, Douglas Zeltman, and wife Valerie of Colorado. A graveside service will be held for Mrs. Buchanan at 1 p.m. on Friday, December 22nd, at Mount Sylvan Cemetery, under the direction of Hilliard Funeral Home in Van, Texas. A reception will follow at Mount Sylvan Baptist Church. If desired, memorials may be made to Hospice of Midland or Mount Sylvan Baptist Church. Jimmy Dale Grisham, known to friends as Jim, passed away on November 10th in Wylie, Texas. He was 87 years old. He was born in 1936 in Quanah, Texas, to Marvin and Ruby Grisham. In 1958, he moved to Fort Benning, Georgia, where he enlisted in the Army. At Fort Benning, he met Barbara Ann French. They were married in 1960. They lived most of their married life in Odessa, where they raised their children. Jim was a successful salesman for State Chemical Company for 25 years, and then for Mayfield Paper Company for 26 years. They moved to Germantown, Tennessee in 2013 to be closer to family. Jim is preceded in death by his parents and his younger brother, Thomas Grisham. He is survived by daughter Gwen and Steve Lovelace of Collierville, Tennessee, his son Stephen, and his wife Char of El Dorado, Kansas, his brother Kenneth and Shirley of Albuquerque, New Mexico, as well as six grandchildren and three great-grandchildren. There will be a memorial service on January 13th at 10 a.m. at Charles W. Smith and Sons Funeral Home in Sauksie, Texas. Juanita Avalos, beloved wife, mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, passed away on December 19th. Juanita was born on November 15, 1936, in Robstown, Texas, to Trinidad Rubio Sr. and Petra Tanguma. Juanita met the love of her life, Pedro, in Staten, Texas. Their 40 years of marriage were filled with love, laughter, and countless cherished memories with each other and their children. Juanita worked at Staten ISD for many years and retired in the year 2000. She took pride in her work and formed lasting bonds with her co-workers and students. Juanita is preceded in death by her husband Pedro Avalos Sr., daughters Jesusa Valenzuela, Linda Salcido, Margie Dominguez, Janie Martinez, granddaughter Cynthia Martinez, parents Trinidad and Petra Rubio Sr., brothers Frank Rubio, Trinidad Rubio Jr., sisters Amelia Rubio and Emilia Olguin. She is survived by her son, Pedro Pete Avalos Jr., and wife Kathy, daughter Anita Avalos Sanchez and husband Oscar, brother Juan Rubio, sisters Teresa Booth, Lupe Mendoza, Valentina Casares, grandchildren Pete Dominguez, Paul Dominguez, Danny Dominguez, Jennifer Bender, Donna Martinez, Christopher Chris Avalos, Brianna Avalos, Sarah Walker, Francisco Frankie Sanchez, as well as 17 great-grandchildren. A visitation will be held Thursday, December 21st from 9 a.m. to 8 p.m., with a rosary starting at 7 p.m. at Staten Memorial Funeral Home. Funeral Mass will be held at 10 a.m. on Friday, December 22nd, at St. Joseph's Catholic Church. Interment will follow at St. Joseph's Catholic Cemetery. In remembrance of Juanita's life, the family is asking, in lieu of flowers, to consider a donation to a charity of your choice. The family would like to express their sincere gratitude to Midland Medical Lodge and Interim Hospice for their loving care of Juanita. Funeral arrangements are entrusted to Staten Memorial Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at www.stantonfh.org. midlandreporter.com. Kathy A. Gibson of Midland passed away on December 15th in Midland. A celebration of her life and legacy will be held at Christ Church Anglican, 5501 North Midkiff in Midland, on December 21st at 11 a.m. Arrangements are entrusted to American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory in Midland.
Good morning, this is Kim, and I am reading the Odessa American. Today's date is Thursday, December 21st. MISD Board approves architect for new elementary school. The Midland community in November passed a $1.4 billion bond referendum that will see new high schools, a new elementary school, and improvements at campuses across Midland ISD. A month later, work has already begun. The MISD Board of Trustees, at its regular meeting Tuesday, received an update on the progress underway. Trustees voted to approve the hiring of architecture and engineering services firm Park Hill for the new elementary school to be built in the fast-growing Lone Star Trails area of Midland. Park Hill is the same firm that was chosen for the construction of Faskin and Yarborough Elementary Schools last decade. The new school's design will be similar to these facilities. This saves money in the design and construction phases and speeds up the construction timeline. Plus, the design has been very popular with teachers, students, and staff. It implements a neighborhood model whereby each grade has its own dedicated space that includes restrooms, movable walls to enlarge classrooms when needed, and a common area. Several requests for quotes have been issued. Scoring of the submissions from architects and engineers is currently underway, and a pool of firms will be brought to trustees in January for consideration of approval. Trustees approved Park Hill as the program manager in November. An RFQ for underwriting services has also been issued, and responses are due December 21st. A committee will score the responses and bring them to the board for consideration of approval in February. Discussions concerning bond sales will begin after underwriters have been selected. MISD has issued an RFQ for surveying and geotechnical services, and a pool of vendors will be brought to the board for consideration of approval in January. Bond Advisory Committee. The committee held its first meeting in November, where its 24 members received reports on district operations, finance, and communications efforts. The committee will meet quarterly. The Advisory Committee, as well as the Bond Planning Committee, were recognized at the December trustees meeting for their dedication to this massive undertaking that will reshape education in Midland for decades to come. Stay up to date with the progress of executing the bond at MidlandBond2023.com. Pfluger responds to Colorado Supreme Court. Congressman August Pfluger, Texas 11, released a statement following the decision by the Colorado Supreme Court to remove President Trump from the 2024 presidential primary ballot. The Colorado Supreme Court's decision to block President Trump from the ballot is blatantly unconstitutional. The U.S. Supreme Court should immediately take up the case and restore the right of voters to decide the outcome of elections, Pfluger said in a news release. Health officials push to get school children vaccinated as more U.S. parents opt out. When Idaho had a rare measles outbreak a few months ago, health officials scrambled to keep it from spreading. In the end, 10 people all in one family were infected, all unvaccinated. This time, the state was lucky, said the region's medical director, Dr. Perry Jansen. The family quickly quarantined and the children were already taught at home. The outbreak could have been worse if the kids were in public school, given the state's low vaccination rate, he said. In Idaho last year, parents opted out of state-required vaccines for 12% of kids entering kindergarten, the highest rate in the nation. We tend to forget that diseases like measles and polio used to kill people, said Jansen, medical director of the Southwest District Health Department, which handled the outbreak in September. All states require children to have certain routine vaccines to go to public school and often private school and daycare to prevent outbreaks of once common childhood diseases like measles, mumps, whooping cough, chickenpox, and polio. All provide exemptions for children who have a medical reason for avoiding the shots. Most also offer waivers for religious beliefs. 15 allow a waiver for any personal belief. Last school year, vaccination waivers among kindergartners hit an all-time high, 3% in total, according to a recent Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report. Waivers for religious or personal beliefs have been on the rise, driven by some states loosening laws, in others by vaccine misinformation and political rhetoric amplified during the COVID-19 pandemic. In Idaho, a parent only has to provide a signed statement to get a waiver. The state's health department said a change in state law before the 2018-19 school year made it easier to get waivers. The state's exemption rate that year was 7.7%. September's measles outbreak started when a resident of Nampa, the state's third largest city, returned home from a road trip abroad. Measles is usually brought into the U.S. through travel since widespread vaccination has all but eliminated local spread of the disease. It takes a very high level of vaccination, around 95%, to protect against the spread of measles and other diseases, experts say. During the pandemic, the national rate for vaccinations among kindergartners dropped to 93%. Health experts say interventions on every level are needed to get more kids immunized. Doctors talking to parents, social media campaigns, easier access to vaccines in some areas, enforcement by schools in others. Last year, most states had an increase in waivers. Hawaii, which allows medical and religious waivers, saw rates double from the previous school year. Nearly 6.5% of kindergartners have an exemption for at least one required vaccine. It's impossible to know the reasons behind a waiver, said Ronald Balihadia, immunization program manager for Hawaii State Department of Health. But misinformation about COVID-19 vaccines has bled through routine vaccines that people wouldn't normally question, Balihada said. While some states have made it easier to opt out, others have clamped down. Connecticut eliminated its long-standing religious waiver for vaccinations in 2021, joining California, West Virginia, New York, and Maine in allowing only medical exemptions. The change drew protests and lawsuits. With only a medical waiver now, the kindergartner vaccination rate reached 97% or above last year. Waiver rates dropped to less than 1%. The state is still working on ways to get more parents on board by answering their questions and not just dismiss them. It's our best shot at trying to bring people along, said Dr. Manisha Juthani, commissioner of the Connecticut Department of Public Health. Georgia has the second largest drop in vaccine waivers last year, from 4.7% to 3.8%. State health officials cited a steady post-pandemic return to partnerships between schools, public health, and pediatricians as possible reasons for the improvement. Dr. Angela Haibaugh-Battle has cared for kids in rural Georgia for 17 years. Now in the small coastal community of St. Mary's, she said she spends more time now talking to parents wary about routine childhood vaccines. Every connection, every conversation is a chance to educate, she said. It's not about winning or losing, she said. Sparks says no endorsement in local GOP race. Ector County GOP Party Chair Tisha Crow this week said State Senator Kevin Sparks had endorsed her candidacy as he faces local Ector County Republican Women's President Donna Kelm in the March primary for control of the local GOP. Crow shared text message screenshots where she asked Sparks for an email to include her announcement so she could forward it to the Salisbury and wrote, "I need to insert your endorsement first," and later thanked him for his effort on her behalf. In the text message screenshots, he replied his staff was typing it up and that he would check on what happened with the email. He never used the word endorsement in his response to Crow. On the Odessa American Facebook page, Crow posted screenshots of their text messages and said, "Don't you think any reasonable and prudent person would assume endorsement?" Apparently, that is not the case. Sparks' office this week said he was not endorsing in this or any other local race. Crow posted her screenshots after his office detailed their no endorsement policy to the OA. On Wednesday, Sparks reiterated his non-endorsement policy to the OA. He texted, "Both candidates have been very active in Ector County for many years. The community needs to make their election without undue influence." He said he is not endorsing either candidate and does not intend to endorse in other races. He said he has spoken with both Kelm and Crow on the matter. When contacted by the OA following Kelm's announcement of her candidacy, Sparks praised her work. "I have known Donna Kelm for several years as a committed member of the Ector County GOP. As the current president of the Ector County Republican Women, she has proven to be an effective leader for Republicans in our community. Donna is a voice of reason and very qualified for the position of Ector County GOP chairman. Chairperson. Kelm has said her hope is to get the Ector County GOP back on track. She said that means an end to Crow's time as the head of the party. Kelm said she is against some of the current tactics being used against endorsing one Republican over another in local races and the use of fake social media accounts to attack Odessans who question the local GOP. Kelm herself was treated harshly at the ECRP headquarters after she refused to block walk for candidates that she did not know. Kelm wants to create an environment where candidates feel free to run without being intimidated and will speak out against executive board members who lash out and bully candidates they oppose. Kelm worked for more than a month to secure 3 signatures from current Ector County precinct chairs so she could get a spot on the ballot to challenge longtime leader Crow. The signatures were required under Texas legislation that originally passed to keep Democrats from grabbing powerful seats by running for local party chair spots. Crow and her supporters have long said it is the law and challengers must get 10% of the local party chairs to sign to even get on the ballot. However, the statute also details that counties under a certain population may opt out of the required 10% in signatures. Midland County has done just that, but Crow and her precinct chairs have not. Many of the current precinct chairs were appointed by Crow or have never faced an opponent. That changes this March as local businessman Ronnie Lewis gathered a number of Odessans to challenge the city precinct chairs for control of the party. Crow and her people have sought to paint him as a Democratic operative, but Lewis said he is a Republican and just wants civility back for the bullying of Odessans by top leadership of the local GOP to stop. He cites how fake Facebook accounts are used to intimidate and bully anyone who doesn't agree with everything they are doing. Earlier this year, several fake profiles were used to disparage Lewis and his wife. The fake profiles, Finnegan Lane, Josiah Vargas, Mitt Harvey, Joshua Benjamin, and others routinely denigrate Lewis and others. Lewis will face Carmen Wilhite in the primary. She was appointed to her precinct chair several years ago. Josuyak says recent allegations easily explained. Former Odessa Municipal Court Director Kimberly Josuyak said her replacement is a good, long-standing friend of hers, but she's just misinformed about many of the statements she made during last week's city council meeting. Josuyak left the court last month to become the municipal court director in Garland. Her departure came a little more than a year after former assistant city manager Philip Urishia became assistant city manager in that community. Interim director Leah Huff Albertson told the council last month that municipal court wasn't communicating with the Odessa Police Department about tickets not being processed, that money orders and checks were being stuffed into drawers, and that the state fined the city thousands of dollars for late report filings. Huff Albertson said that since she came aboard, she realized there is a glitch in the software for electronic citations given by the Odessa Police Department that OPD was unaware of. The glitch resulted in tickets not showing up in the system. I did not realize that until I came. No one was giving them any tickets. These errors were put in a drawer and had lots of checks and money with them. And anyway, a whole other story there, Huff Albertson said. I know you're laughing, but it really is true. You can't make this up. Josuyak said she was in constant communication with OPT Director Yolanda Rincon about the glitches with the ticket writer software. Lists of missing citations were created and shared, she said. It was quite common for people to come into the court to pay for a ticket and for court staff to not find the ticket in the system, Josuyak said. It also wasn't uncommon for people to mail the court checks and money orders for tickets that also could not be found. Every time we could figure out citations were missing or there were some other issue, we'd notify her and she would contact their vendor and they would work on it and try to figure it out, Josuyak said. Every day, court supervisor Kashiva Smith would take the checks and money orders that had been mailed in and check the system to see if the missing tickets were imported, Josuyak said. At the end of the day, those not matched up with incoming tickets would be returned to the safe, Josuyak said. When a fellow court staffer notified City Hall, Smith was planning to turn in her 2 weeks' notice. Smith was told her services were no longer needed and she had to leave her post midday, Josuyak said. She suspects that that's why there were checks and money orders found in a drawer rather than in a safe. I have advised the OPD has had so many problems with the software company that at one point Chief Mike Gerke was fed up with them and was going to just scrap it and go to someone else after they'd been working on it for months, Josuyak said. They begged and begged and said, let us work on it, let us work on it. So he gave them 2 weeks, and at the end of the 2 weeks was right when I left. As for the city being fined thousands of dollars for late filing report filings, Josuyak stated she filed the October report for September's activity with the Office of Court Administration prior to her November 1st departure. The subsequent report was due November 20th. Huff Albertson also told the City Council it's taking people 3 to 4 months to get a first court date after receiving a ticket. However, Josuyak said that, too, isn't entirely accurate. When people receive tickets, their first court date is printed right on it, and it's 14 days from that date. And while subsequent pre-trial hearings are often delayed for months, it's because the city attorney's office has never returned to full staff since city attorney Natasha Brooks was fired December 13, 2022, and several of her staff members quit in protest, Josuyak said. Huff Albertson also spoke at length about improving communications between the courts and the city by creating additional reports. Josuyak said that several types of the reports Huff Albertson was talking about already exist and she would regularly share them with Urishia and later then City Manager Michael Marrero and then Assistant Manager Aaron Smith. However, when Agapito Bernal took over, when Marrero and Smith were fired, he did not take her up on her offer to continue sending the reports, she said. Well, she sent Risha reports monthly and met with him every other week. She met with Bernal twice during the 11 months she worked with him, Jozbiak said. Huff Albertson has also been touting the recent purchase of kiosks to improve efficiency at the court, but Jozbiak said she was the one to purchase the first kiosk. According to city records, the city council approved the purchase of two additional kiosks from AdComp Systems November 28th. The price of the kiosk plus the software, cameras, training, and annual remote support came to roughly $74,000. According to LinkedIn, Mansur Plummer is the owner of AdComp Systems and founder of New and Blue. Huff Albertson is listed as the director of technology on both their websites. The CEO of New and Blue is Mike Wilson of T2 Professional Consulting, which was hired by Mayor Javier Hoven hours after the city council fired Marrero and Brooks without explanation. New and Blue's slogan is law enforcement technology by cops for cops. Jozwiak, who came aboard right as the pandemic struck, said she and her staff had lots of challenges. The city had just purchased new software from Tyler Technologies, and no prep work had been done before it was implemented. So we struggled for a very long time trying to create workflows as we're working, creating workflows and creating queues and creating a standard operating procedure manual that would match and flow with the software, she said. On top of that, Jozwiak discovered a backlog of more than 100,000 cases going back to the 1980s that needed to be cleared up. Much has been said about the court writing off thousands of dollars in unpaid fines, but state law dictates that specific cases may be deemed uncollectible by the court after 15 years, she said. They were indiscriminately closed without authority, she stressed. Jozwiak said she began going through the backlog at the request of then-assistant city manager Cindy Muncy because outside auditors mentioned it could be detrimental to cities to carry so much uncollectible debt. It was just happenstance that they had passed the statute about tickets 15 years or older later that same year. The court can find those uncollectible and give them off to your city's books because it was causing concerns with auditors all over the state of Texas, Jozwiak said. Jozwiak also questioned Huff Albertson's plan for OPD to train current staff to become bailiffs. She worries about the time when an unruly defendant will require hands-on detainment and have to be taken into custody. Law enforcement officers must go through police academies to become certified police officers. Court staff are regular citizens with no authority to detain or arrest, she said. Having said all this, Jozwiak said, there are always ways to improve, and many of Huff Albertson's plans are excellent. Jozwiak, whose endorsement of Huff Albertson is on the interim director's LinkedIn page, said she hopes she's successful in implementing them. I have known Leah for many years, and based on what I know, she will be a perfect fit for the city of Odessa, Jozwiak said. I wish them much luck and best wishes. Faucet commissioners tangle over airport. Dallas Airline withdraws from Odessa flights. Ector County Judge Dustin Faucett and the County Commissioners and Odessa Airport Schlemmer Field Board of Directors aren't getting along, and their big bone of contention is the county-owned airport. You could say they flat don't like one another. Faucett says the commissioners were wrong to cancel Texas Aero's fixed-based operator contract October 24th, and Precinct 3 Commissioner Don Stringer and Airport Board Chairman Mark Merritt says Faucett is beholden to Texas Aero President Billy Mayer of Waco for giving over $40,000 to the judge's 2022 election campaign. Fawcett blames the commissioners and airport board for the recent withdrawal of the hop-on jet service, JSX Airlines of Dallas, and its verbal commitment to start flying over out of Schlemmer in January, while Stringer and Merritt say it's not much of a loss because the airport is already about as busy as it can get, and Delta Airlines recently stated intention to begin short hauls out of Midland International Air and Spaceport was probably the main reason for JSX's decision. Fawcett says the commissioners and airport board also stubbed their toes in July 2021 when they rejected a $15 million grant from the Texas Department of Transportation to extend a Schlemmer runway because it would have been a major economic development initiative, although the county commission and airport board members said then that they were dubious because the grant would have entailed a $1.5 million obligation by the county, and it wouldn't have covered ramp and taxiway improvements, among other reservations. Efforts to reach Mayor for comment were unsuccessful Tuesday and Wednesday, but Stringer said Texas Aero is welcome to bid for the new FBO contract, and he will support the company if it offers the best bid, although the terms will have to be much more favorable to the county than the previous deal. Texas Aero spent a whole lot of money than they should have to elect Fawcett, and they've got to be loyal to them, said Stringer, who is the commissioner's court liaison to the airport board. People have got to wonder why someone would spend so much money in Ector County to buy a judge. It's my job to protect the taxpayers and have the best contract in place for them, whereas it's the judge's interest to protect Texas Aero and Billy Mayer, who put him in office. Stringer said Mayer had bought the FBO contract from the previous operator. Billy gets the majority of the revenues for fuel sales and hangar leases, while the county gets the expenses, and he will do everything he can to keep the contract, he said. We are supposed to have full access to his audits, which he wouldn't disclose to us, but his annual revenues should be around $1.2 million. He has no expenses other than his employees. Merritt said the airport permanently houses 125 privately owned airplanes and accommodates other 55 that regularly use it, adding that Schlemmer recorded 30,000 landings and takeoffs in 2022. Fawcett said a group including Mayer contributed more than $40,000 in-kind services, like mailers late in his campaign, but only after he stated his position on the airport as a Republican Party debate. I'm not beholden to Billy, the judge said. That is a mischaracterization and very ill-informed statement. I have taken my stance on the airport after the airport board and commissioners squandered the $15 million. The airport should be used for economic development, but the commissioners and the airport board are very protectionist for a bunch of rich individuals who own airplanes and want a place to fly their toys on the weekends. They don't want to expand the air services, and they use the straw argument that big freight liners would have been flying over and disturbing the neighborhood, but we were not going to have 737s flying in, Fawcett said. He said one reason JSX withdrew was that they had been made aware of what happened with Texas Aero in this silly political battle. So I can't blame somebody for not wanting to come here till we get this thing settled, he said. Texas Tech named as a first scholars institution. Texas Tech University has advanced to the first scholars phase of the First Scholars Network, an initiative of the Center for First Generation Student Success, funded by the National Association of Student Personnel Administrators, NASPA, and the Souter Foundation. Texas Tech was chosen based on its demonstrated commitment to advancing the outcomes of first-generation students through improving both first-generation student success initiatives and institution-wide approaches. We proudly champion our first-generation students, who comprise nearly one-third of our student body. Mitzi Lauderdale, Vice Provost of Academic Innovation and Student Success, said in a news release, the support from NASPA and the Souter Foundation propels Texas Tech forward as a first scholars institution, offering resources for students to navigate uncharted academic terrain, illuminating the path for future generations. Texas Tech has entered the first phase of four through support and resources available to first-gen students, such as transition and mentoring programs, federally funded TRIO programs such as McNair, Upward Bound, and others, and a first-generation learning community. Texas Tech does not believe it is any one person's job to serve first-gen students, Senior Director of Student Development and Engagement Brandon Cruz said in the release. We take a holistic approach and strive to support students through every touch point they have. The accomplishment comes after years of development. The university received a first forward designation in 2019 from the Center for First Generation Student Success and was then named a First Gen Forward Advisory Institution in 2021. Being named a First Scholars Institution is the next step. At Texas Tech, our faculty, staff, and administrators have a personal understanding of the challenges and opportunities confronting first-generation students, said Texas Tech Provost Ron Hendrick. A significant number of us have personally navigated the journey of being first-generation graduates. Understanding alone is insufficient. By adopting systematic approaches to addressing the unique needs of first-generation students, we enhance the resources available to all students at Texas Tech. FBI offering reward of up to $25,000 for information on cold case. The FBI is offering up to $25,000 for information leading to the identification, arrest, and conviction of the individuals responsible for the 1994 murder of John Gary Monroe. John was a husband living in San Antonio prior to his death. John entered Big Bend National Park in Texas on October 30, 1994, to go camping. On November 2, 1994, his body was discovered at a campsite by a group of hikers at approximately 5:15 p.m., a news release detailed. John was a 43-year-old at the time of his murder. Although he was residing in San Antonio at the time of his death, he also had ties to Houston. John was described as follows: sex, male, height, 5'9 to 5'11, age 43 at time of death, weight 155 pounds, race, white, build, medium built, eyes blue, hair blonde. Anyone with information regarding this homicide should call the FBI's toll-free tip line at 1-800-CALL-FBI, 1-800-225-5324, or submit a tip online at tips.fbi.gov.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.